Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Blightmare by A.J. Alto, narrated by Amy McFadden. Chapter 1. I landed a punch, and the resounding slam of glove on body was satisfying. When he dropped his right hand, I threw a left hook, eagerly, with passion, feeling the warmth in my body like it was an elixir of salvation. The blows were mine today, over and over. When he didn't come back at me fast enough for my liking, an impatient growl snagged in the back of my throat. Swiping my upper lip sweat on the gauze bandage on my right forearm, I danced on the balls of my feet, ready, eager, spoiling to engage.
"Chin down," Hood told me. "You're lifting your chin on the reach. Keep it tucked."
I took that under advisement and threw a few body jabs downstairs, dropping to keep my eye level with my blows. I swung into defense before coming in with my knee. He blocked me and counterpunched rapidly, and I slipped and rolled under them, light and fast, anticipating his reactions, waiting for a clear shot.
"Elbows in tight," he corrected. "You're looking for the shots. Don't telegraph. Slappy today, Mars."
I checked that, then surprised him, shuffling my dominant leg back and throwing a left leg kick, catching him solidly on the side of his thigh.
"Nice," he barked. "That was not sloppy. You've been practicing that."
"That's right," I thought with a sniff. "Marnie 3.0 up in the house now." He threw a right that I caught, redirected, and countered. When he came back at me with his favorite jab-cross-hook combo, I dodged, blocked, and ducked. I changed the rhythm up, dropping my defense on my right side to draw him in. He took the bait and jabbed there. I slipped and hooked, again landing a solid shot. He nodded, pleased that I was controlling the pace. I feigned a low blow to the inner thigh and instead went high, catching his headgear with a sweet thwap. The alarm on his wristband went off, and he backed off. I advanced, not finished with him. Rob maintained his distance, stalking off to the left, watching me from across the blue mats, breathing more heavily than I'd seen him do in a while.
"We're done."
"Nope," I said.
"You're not all in.
Don't think I can't tell, either. Let's go another 15. And this time, don't treat me like we've never done this before."
"I'm done. Which means we're done,"
he said, moving to the bench for his water bottle. While he drank in small sips, he looked at me expectantly, the way a zookeeper keeps a wary eye on a jungle cat. His eyes said he understood my need to fight some more, but the set of his shoulders warned me to back off. I did. Taking off my headgear and sparring gloves, I tossed them on top of my bag and then planted both bare hands on my hips. His gaze cut to them for the third time today. I was no longer wearing my leather gloves to block that particular talent. A touch psychic with bare hands was liable to get visions and impressions from everything she so much as brushed. I had long since stopped giving a shit. Let the visions rage. I could handle it. I could handle anything, right? If I kept lying to myself that way, maybe it would become true. In the meantime, I was drowning in stimuli, which was still better than being alone with my thoughts. My thoughts were assholes. The room smelled of fresh sweat and old athletic padding. I watched Rob catch his breath while he shifted and stretched his muscles.
"Harry told you to take it easy on me today,"
I noted, trying to keep my voice friendly. It still came out more harshly than intended. I hadn't managed to get my sense of humor back in the 2 months Batten had been gone, and when the humor did come, it was a dark, bitter thing with sharp edges and unkind hooks and barbs. The temptation to laugh felt disloyal, like I shouldn't let myself be amused or amusing yet. The sheriff of Lambert County rolled his eyes so grandly, Harry would have been impressed.
"If I listened to everything your dead guy told me to do, I'd never put a hand on you, except to coat you in 6 layers of bubble wrap."
That, I believed. Harry had enjoyed the concept of me learning the skills to defend myself, to get in shape, to handle guns and other weapons. Well, he had, back before we lost Batten. His attitude on the matter had since shifted dramatically. Harry wanted me home on the couch, snuggled securely in a blanket, eating cookies all day, waiting for him to wake at dusk so he could coddle me like a bird with a broken wing. That, in my opinion, was some serious limp twattery. I wasn't broken. I was managing just fine, thank you very much. Okay, maybe not fine, but I was managing. I thought I was managing. Maybe nobody else thought so, but they could jump up each other's assholes. Okay, they definitely thought I wasn't managing, because with the leather gloves off, I got a dose of doubt and concern every time I popped hood, even through the sparring gloves. I didn't need an adultier adult adulting at me when I was trying to punch him, though it did make me want to slug him harder. It was a vicious cycle of a feedback loop. I wanted to smack him for feeling worried about my well-being and state of mind, and every time I connected, I got a reminder of his worry. Maybe I should have asked him to teach me some kicks instead. Hood took off his gloves with a loud tear of Velcro and squatted near his bag with less ease than usual. I squinted at his knee. Did I catch you wrong?
Nope.
He lied, and the blue sense, my constant companion now, reported his fib clearly.
You sure? I asked, concerned. Give me your hand.
Fuck off, Mars,
he grumbled, and swiped a towel from the bench nearby to wipe his face and neck down.
Don't start that groper shit with me today. I'm in no mood.
Rob?
No.
He pointed at me with the sweaty towel.
When you ask for space, I give it to you. You're going to show me the same respect.
Point Hood. I nodded, checking my tracker wristband to ballpark how much running I could fit in. A Canadian girl at heart, I'd set my app to the metric system, despite Hood's determination to instruct me in miles and pounds.
Fair enough, I said, wiggling my witchy fingers at him. But if you want me to fix it, you can find me on the track. Gonna go do 5K.
I turned to leave the sparring room, and Hood snagged me, hooking my elbow before I could get to the door. His hand was gentle but unrelenting.
Oh, no, you're not. I know you've got the whole day-sitter endurance thing going for you, but you've been at it for 3 hours already. Hit the showers, and then we're going to hydrate. What have you eaten today? Anything?
The truth was, I couldn't remember putting anything in my stomach but coffee, caffeine pills, and my herbal supplements to shake off the grogginess from the sleeping pills I'd taken the night before, to keep the nightmares away. Harry kept finding the uppers like he was a goddamn drug-sniffing dog, and he kept unhelpfully replacing them with bremelanotide. That much, at least, I could appreciate, since he and I were so not having sexy times. And even though I'm sure the Overlord would understand, I definitely didn't need him getting up my nose because he wasn't getting his nookie fix through my bond with Harry either. So, I had to store my perky pills at the office, which meant driving into Ten Springs at 6, still groggy, and being reminded that it used to be the office that Batten and I shared, all before meeting Rob at the gym. If I hadn't been a morning person before, I sure as fuck wasn't one now.
I'll grab a protein shake after my run,
I evaded, and twisted my arm to force Hood to let go. His squawked complaint was ridiculous. He'd taught me how to get out of that hold himself. I slipped out of the sparring room and went to the nearest side of the track to check my laces. Hood didn't follow me, but his disapproval did. The track was almost empty but for a few spry seniors power walking in the outside lane, and a guy I had started to refer to as my buddy. For the past month or so, he'd been hanging around the track every day at the same time I was, and seemed to maneuver himself into the same rooms Hood and I occupied, even when we switched it up for variety. The only place he didn't follow, besides the locker room and bathroom, was the sparring room. Maybe he didn't want to see just how badly I could kick his ass. Buddy was slightly less than 6 feet tall, in fair physical shape, and was polite with his eye beams, in that he was attempting to be careful not to let me see when he was checking me out. It had taken me weeks to catch on, mostly because I wasn't in a noticing people place. When I mentioned him to Hood, I got the "you should have seen him earlier" frown of consternation. Part of my self-defense training involved noting suspicion-worthy people and details that might relate to my safety. I didn't get any danger vibes from Buddy, even after I clued into his always-there-ness. As far as I was concerned, he was just a dude who preferred to work out at the same time I did. Every day. Where I was exercising. I wasn't worried. I mean, I could have been worried, but that would have meant I needed to give two feathered fucks. Fortunately, I found myself freshly fuckless. I took a second to do the details thing with Buddy. Dark brown hair, blue eyes, gray track pants, red and gray sneakers, Blue Jays baseball cap that he took off before running, before I decided to do 10 kilometers instead of 5. My personal best so far, without any witchy intervention, was 49 minutes, but I was feeling particularly spunky today. I was already warmed up, I had energy to blow off that I hadn't burned off sparring with Hood, and my mental confidence was high. I adjusted my short black ponytail. I had chopped it above my shoulders yesterday, and my ghost hair was already brushing them again. I could see Hood on the other side of the safety glass. He flashed me 5 fingers, a command, not a request, and then shot one in the direction of the men's shower room. I showed him 10 fingers. When he scowled, I showed him my favorite one, on both hands. I would have my run whether my red-headed mother hen clucked or not. I took one last moment to check in with myself, looking for any funny or odd sensations. I'd passed another full moon successfully, and by that I mean without growing a pelt of fur and my bones cracking and realigning. This morning I didn't sense anything foxy within, and nothing foxier than usual. I didn't know if I would, or should. I couldn't see any signs of whether or not the lycanthropic virus from Gunther Folkenflik's bite had taken hold in my body. Though lycanthropes were the most studied cryptid on the books, they were still considered legally human, and medical studies were strictly voluntary. Most lycanthropes refused. The stigma was deeply ingrained, with workplace and social discrimination the sad norm. As a result, there were too many lingering medical mysteries about the virus, and I felt like I was finding my way blind on my situation. A wait-and-see proposition. Wait-and-see sucked a box of hairy balls through a bendy straw. Buddy had started his first lap by the time I joined him, which meant to catch me, he had to pick up the pace, and I had no intention of making it easy for him. When he fell in behind me, he slowed up again. One of these days, I was going to stop dead and shout, "Boo!" just to see what would happen. Until that day, I worked hard at ignoring the sound of his cross-trainers striking the track a few steps behind me. I smirked at how hard he was breathing to keep up. 46 minutes later, I slowed to do a cool-down lap and pumped a fist at my side. Personal record time. I'd lost Buddy at some point, either because he couldn't keep that pace as long as I had, or he simply hadn't had 10K in his workout plan. In any case, I entered the locker room on a runner's high. After quickly showering and changing into black jeans, a black shirt, belted on my holster purse, and laced up my worn Doc Marten boots, I finger-combed and braided my unruly turquoise and black ghost hair into a thick, wet plait. I reapplied a careful layer of gauze to the werefox bite on my forearm and the burn scar around my neck from where Asmodeus had tail-whipped me in Skulisdottir. Without looking too long at my reflection, I finished up and hit the bricks. Rob was waiting just outside the gym, now in his brown Lambert County sheriff's uniform, sans hat, smelling fresh and looking concerned. When I breezed past him with my bag over my shoulder, he followed me to my new Buick. "If you're gonna arrest me, I think you should know, officer," I said amicably. "I plan to resist and can probably take you. Better get your cuffs ready." He drawled a dorky fake laugh for me.
"Yuck, yuck. I think you should start getting relaxation massages, or therapy, or consider taking a yoga class."
"Already do yoga at home."
"Something relaxing," he went on, ignoring me. None of that Pilates fusion or Bikram hot power yoga. Just gentle stuff.
Saying I need to chill out, Red?
I'm saying you need to slow down.
I stopped at the Buick and opened the trunk to toss in my bag, and then checked the time on my phone and turned the ringer back on. It dinged that I had missed messages and texts waiting. I'd deal with them at the office.
I'm late for work.
Hood tried to take my elbow again, but this time I dodged it.
You're the boss, he said.
Umema's the boss.
I shrugged.
I made her my manager, so I'd be accountable to someone.
No one is expecting you until 11.
You don't know my appointment schedule. I scoffed, then shot him a look.
Harry told you.
What is this, a tag team? I did my lofty but still terrible British impression of Harry.
You talk to her, officer. She won't bloody listen to me.
Look, I appreciate the concern, but you can stow it. Both of you need to stop clucking. I'm fine.
What did you eat today?
Hood asked again. I sighed, rolling my head back to stare up at the dreary March sky. Harry made me 2 eggs, scrambled, with red peppers and a side of rye toast. Buttered. Happy? I checked. He did not look at all happy.
You know I can call and confirm that, right?
Not until after dusk, smartass.
I also know you've got no business policing what I eat. But if it blows your skirt up, Sheriff, knock yourself out.
There's no point in my coaching you if you don't listen to my advice.
Point Hood. I sighed and nodded.
I know. You're getting real good at lying to me, and I don't like it one bit.
Hood chewed the inside of his mouth.
You think I can't tell you haven't eaten? You're hungry.
I'm not, I said honestly. I hadn't felt like eating in weeks, not since the don't do this. I started seeing the throne room, flashes of color, the marble floor, dark wings, a red hat, a bloody scrap of leather jacket, a dead queen, and shook it off. Nope, nope, nope.
Your body is hungry,
Rob said, kindly now, reading my pinched expression.
I can see the weight loss in your face.
Can you see the I'm gonna clobber you in my face, too?
I tried to joke. He carried on like he hadn't heard me.
You're also dehydrated. You can't live on coffee and vitamins.
I'll add some vodka to my diet.
And sleeping pills, and caffeine pills, and whatever else gets me through this mess.
Are we done with the lecture, Red?
Don't do that.
I sighed, feeling helpless. What would you like me to do?
Talk to me,
he said.
And if you can't do that, at least have a meal. Pop by Claire's and throw down on a plate of pancakes with a side of fruit. Glass of milk won't kill you, but I might, if you keep up this self-destructive bullshit. Understood?
He was right, and he was trying to help, and I felt like a proper asshole. I couldn't look at him for a full minute, squinting across the parking lot at the intense sun turning all the windshields to Klieg lamps. I noticed my avid fan, Blue Jay's hat back on, limping a little on his left leg, heading out to his car, and I motioned in his direction with my chin.
There goes my buddy. Good, Hood grumbled. I want to run those plates. Make sure he doesn't have prior convictions for criminal harassment or felony stalking.
Then he swung his no-nonsense gaze back at me, not about to be distracted that easily.
Pancakes. Promise?
I bobbed a nod.
Yes, sir. And I want you fueled up an hour before our next workout. Yogurt. Oatmeal.
Yes, sir. Even if it's just a bit, he said, softening his voice.
I understand your stomach is off right now. I get that. Morning does a number on a body. I've been there, Mars.
He'd been a mess after losing Neil Dunnichy, his chief deputy, but I'd been so busy trying to save my own ass that I hadn't taken any notice. And, technically, Dunnichy had been lost, found, and then had his reanimated corpse blown up. That was bound to be tough on a guy's best friend. If anyone understood what I was going through right now, losing a loved one to monsters and violence, it was Rob. He'd been a good friend these past few months, refusing to be driven off by my prickly moods and sharp tongue, rolling with the punches, both figuratively and literally. He ignored Harry's wishes when it came to coddling me, sensing I needed to work out hard and push my physical limits, and he fielded calls from Golden, Chapel, and De Cabrera with the same advice. If you want to help Marnie, give her space or throw on your sneakers and run with her. It was pretty much the only way to stay in my life right now, unless you wanted to strap on the gloves and spar with me. I kind of felt bad for Harry, who had to listen to the sad and angry litany of my thoughts whenever he wasn't at rest. But I was still mad at him for his part in what had happened. It was complicated and messy, which described my head in a nutshell these days. Hood surprised me by asking,
"What kind of car is he driving?"
My mouth dropped, and I was tempted to check Buddy's car. I hadn't noticed which one he'd gotten into. Big mistake. Hood knew it and sucked his teeth in disapproval.
"Sloppy Mars. It's a truck. Nissan Frontier, silver. Now, if you had had breakfast this morning, you'd be far more alert."
I tried to smile wanly for him, but it got lost in a guilty lip shrug and never quite formed. "I'll eat."
"It's a start," he said. "No more lying to me. Got it?"
"I promise." It felt like a lie, and my chest tightened involuntarily. We were quiet as Buddy's truck drove past. Neither of us looked directly at it.
"You don't want help," Hood said, fishing out his car keys. "But you got it. You can scare the rest of them off. I ain't going anywhere. Hear me?"
That hit home, and I felt my cheeks heat up with a healthy torrent of shame. He waited me out until I could manage to sneak a peek at his face. What I found were understanding and determination.
"Tomorrow?" I asked. "Nope. Tuesday's your day off. See you bright and early. And," he said, enunciating each syllable seriously, "fueled the fuck up on Wednesday. See you then."
With that, he turned and walked away to the Hulk-like Hummer in the furthest parking space in the lot, big black gym bag over his shoulder, swinging his keys on one finger. I watched him go in silence, then checked my texts. Two from Chapel regarding stuff he'd cleaned out of my office, and one from Umema to say she was waiting. For the first time in weeks, my stomach echoed Hood's sentiment.
Maybe I should eat something besides coffee and the occasional cookie stuffed under my nose by my cold company.
The thought of dropping by Claire's for a small plate of something was erased quickly, however, by the summoning ring of my phone. It was Golden. I let it go to voicemail. I hit the drive-thru for a coffee and two cherry Danishes and sped toward the office. Chapter 2. Umema Iyasi was waiting for me, arms crossed, at the front door of our office at 226 Waterdown Avenue. Her dark, brooding eyes, peeking out from between wisps of flat-ironed hair in a mid-length bob that accentuated her pretty, heart-shaped face, silently judged me. I parked in my reserved spot next to the driveway, which I'd claimed with a sign that read, "Witch parking only. All others will be towed." Umema looked as though she disapproved of my lateness, on top of the fact that I hadn't yet given her a key. The rear of the house had been Batten's home, while the front rooms were occupied by my office. The back rooms were still full of Batten's meager possessions, some of which he hadn't even had time to unpack. I couldn't deal with them. I was going to make Umema deal with them, and, much like everything else I wasn't dealing with, I was just going to pretend they weren't there until I could cope. Sometime around the 14th of never. It was in my calendar and everything, filed under Nope. Declan Edgar had helped me rebrand my consulting gig as Helping Hands, since my first name for it, Bare Hand Services, was unanimously shouted down for sounding like a skeezy massage parlor. But I still had a brick of BHS business cards that I didn't know what to do with, but couldn't bear to throw out. Regardless of what it was called, business was steady enough to warrant a full-time employee. Since I'd kind of murdered her last boss, Jeremiah Prost, in a tomb in Egypt, I felt like I owed Umema a job. She and I were learning American Sign Language together, but were stuck in the rudimentary stages, since for years Jeremiah Prost hadn't cared a whit for what his mute day-sitter might have to say. She couldn't yet tell me exactly how deep her irritation ran, but I knew. The Blue Sense reported her impatience but lack of surprise, both of them overlaid with a kind of determination that made me want to be anywhere but between her and something she wanted. Also not a surprise, the fact that pretty much everyone around me was also impatient but determined to get through shit. I wasn't dealing with the loss of Batten well, and I was getting a pretty solid case of cranky pants waiting for the rest of the stages of grief to show up and get their shit together. Waffling back and forth between denial and anger was getting pretty stale, and I was really looking forward to hitting acceptance, and maybe cookies. Cookies was the last stage, right? I might have asked Umema if she could see me at the end of my grief, with cookies or not, but it felt like a crude imposition, especially since her talent was waning with the death of her revenant. Even though he had been a gigantic asshole, that loss was painful and took time to adjust. House Prost was nearly empty, but those revenants who remained were precognitive, and as such, they infused their day-sitters with the talent of seeing the future. What she had seen in her own future involved education and success, something she'd never dared hope for while stuck with him. She had also seen me, and had informed me in her no-nonsense fashion that I was an integral springboard from which she would launch into her own career. While seers tended to ruffle feathers with their ability to tell you how things were going to happen, I found her predictions and demands endearing, inspiring, even. I was resolved to being involved in any way I could. When I'd accepted, she'd shrugged and walked away, having already known that I would. Our first Friday in the office, I'd shown her The Matrix, and she had knocked over our shared bowl of popcorn laughing when the Oracle had told Neo about breaking the vase. Working with her was like that, except I was the one supplying the cookies that Harry insisted on baking. I drained my drive-through coffee and left the empty paper cup in the car, slammed the door, and went around to the trunk, nodding and saying, I know, sorry. Umema was mute but not deaf, and listened to my grumbled apologies nearly every day. I hauled a box heaped with witchcraft supplies out of the trunk. I hadn't been asked to perform any spells by a client yet, mostly performing simple psychic work that proved to be easy money and kept me occupied but not too overwhelmed. Still, I liked to be prepared. I heaved the box against one hip and closed the trunk, then went to the small cement pad that served as a porch. "Have you seen my black tourmalines? I can't find them." I glanced at her to see her shake her head. "I can't remember where I put the stupid bag. I can't make my witch balls without them." Umema's lips twisted into a small, lewd smile, but she didn't make a groin-cupping gesture the way Golden or I might have. She wasn't that comfortable with me yet. But she was getting there. I nodded to acknowledge the smirk and said, "Yeah, yeah, glass balls with herbs and yarn and gems for protection." She did a little "yeah, sure" nod, and the smirk remained. Holding out her arms, she received my box of goodies so I could wrestle with the keys for the front door. The front lock liked to jam and almost always gave me trouble, unless I got lucky and put the key in just right to hit its happy place. I tried not to think about what that said, in conjunction with some balls, but it was pretty easy to quash that line of thought. My libido had fucked off to somewhere in the far Arctic and showed no signs of returning anytime soon. The back door was simple to unlock and easy to jimmy in a fix, but it led into Batten's quarters, and I wasn't remotely ready to face that yet. I was barely able to deal with my own office. I swung the door open and received the scent of the house with my eyes closed, taking a moment to accept the little stab of agony. Batten's house was old enough to have a historical fragrance of heavily polished wood and aging plaster walls, and under that, it still smelled like the fresh paint we'd applied to an office he'd only lived to use a couple times.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?